Never use it. So, good luck.
And so I, as we do very often in the Zen tradition, when there is a question that is being asked, I really sat with that and saw what came up with me for that, with that question. What's peace? How would I approach it? What can we say about it? What does it inspire for me in terms of the Buddhist tradition? And there are a couple of things, that threads that came to me. One thing that obviously it's what's happening in Ukraine, the war, our situation. Our feeling of powerlessness in front of these events, all the sensations that might arise when we hear, when we see what is going on there. And I remembered also while meditating on that is also what came very strongly is Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh, this Vietnamese monk that during the Vietnamese war, the war in Vietnam, he was in a way asked to choose between communism and he was accused by Americans to be communist, or from the other side, not to be involved enough with the communists. And he chose peace. And suddenly what came up was, in the Zen tradition, we have a tendency to, we train to go beyond the discriminating mind, beyond good and evil, beyond concepts, beyond duality, beyond choosing one side over the other. So, was Thich Nhat Hanh choosing the party of peace, falling into discrimination, or was it something else? And then I thought about a very early text that I like very much, which is part of part of what we call the Pali Canon. So really the early texts that have been gathered and put in writing 4 centuries after the death of Shakyamuni, compiled, and this is what the kind of the corpus of text that the Theravada tradition kind of refers to. So one of the earliest document that we have about Buddhism. It's divided in what we call baskets, because they were put in baskets, simply. And divided, kind of the organization of these texts are quite strange, because not strange, but unusual for us Westerners is that it has been organized depending on the length of the texts. So the long texts are part of the long basket, the middle-sized texts are part of the middle-length discourses, and the short texts are part of the short-text discourses. And I thought about one that really kind of struck me when I read it, and I thought about it when thinking about that thing, peace. Because it tells the story about monks going to Shakyamuni and says, "We keep arguing." It's like, "Help us! We keep arguing. We're quarreling all the time, and We disagree all the time. We have disputes. We can't figure it out. No one can be convinced with the other argument. What shall we do? And I find, as often with these texts, early texts, it's very practical. They really come with problems, and so I'm not going to read the whole text. It's not that long, but I'm just want to emphasize certain points that I thought was really interesting to me. And also that will give you a flavor of these type of texts, whether you come from Zen tradition or very used to certain type of texts, or Tibetan tradition, which are later texts usually. And so this monk arrives, and so he says, really, we've been arguing, quarreling, and disputing continually, wounding each other with barbed words. So basically he asks the Buddha, tell us what to do. And so he answers, when you are arguing, quarreling, and disputing, continually wounding each other with barbed words, are you treating your spiritual companions, with kindness by way of body, speech, and mind, both in public and in private? He says, no. No, sir. So it seems that when you're arguing, you're not treating each other with kindness. So what exactly do you know and see, you foolish men, that you behave in such a way? This will be for your lasting harm and suffering. And then the Buddha goes on in evoking six warm-hearted qualities that makes for fondness and respect, and six qualities that he says are conducive to inclusion, harmony, and unity without quarreling. And so he goes on in mentioning the six. He says, treat companions with bodily kindness. Treat companions with verbal kindness. And treat companions with mental kindness. So we have these three items. And then he continues, the fourth one is share without reservation. Without reservation. Just share. Share what you have. Just don't be stingy. You know, we have that precept, don't be stingy with the Dharma. Don't be stingy with what you have. Live according to the precept. So that's fifth. Live according to the precepts. And the sixth, he says, live according to the view, and I quote, that is noble and emancipating and leads one who practices it to the complete ending of suffering. So the complete ending of suffering, this is very kind of Buddhist terminology, but I think it would be rather fair to say lead to peace. Lead to a state, and the reason I'm suggesting a change is so that we don't fall into, because when we talk about the end of suffering, it's very problematic in Buddhism. It refers to a lot of concepts about just the cycle of birth and rebirth and death and all that, so we might be uncomfortable with that. So putting that on the side, just and change it to leading to peace. And that sixth point, it's very interesting, living according to the view. So if you've read few texts from Buddhism, you might encounter the Eightfold Path. an Eightfold Path, the first element of the Eightfold Path is view, appropriate view, or right view sometimes. In Pali, in the language that this text is written, it's ditti. And the Buddha says, this is really, if there is one out of the six which is really the most important, is this view. Do we have an appropriate view? And that view defined the thing that is noble and emancipating, that liberates us, that brings us peace. And so he goes on, and so he should actually find it, because it's really nice the way it says it. It is said here. Of these six warm-hearted qualities, the chief is the view that is noble and emancipating and leads one who practices it to the complete ending of suffering. It holds and binds everything together. It's like a bungalow. The roof peak is the chief point which holds and binds everything together. In the same way, of these six warm-hearted qualities, the chief is the view that is noble and emancipating and leads one who practices it to the complete ending of suffering. It holds and binds everything together. Because they were reciting, they keep repeating the stuff so that it's better to memorize. So it binds things, the view, the appropriate view. And the very, what I do find extremely useful in these texts, that he really tells in these texts, it's really about the how to achieve that. What do you do? Okay, once we say that, what do we do, really? So what do we do practically? We know that there is this quality, but so what do you do with that? And what needs to be done is that it needs to be cultivated. The word cultivated is a word that in these early literature comes back and back and back all the time. Things needs to be cultivated. But it's really actually, I find it really very poetic and very nice the way it's written. It says, so how does the view that is noble and emancipating lead one who practices it to the complete ending of suffering? So what do we do? How do we do it? And the text says, it's when a mendicant has gone to wilderness or to the roof of a tree or to an empty hut, basically on a retreat. You go on a retreat and you reflect like this. Is there anything that I am overcome with internally? To overcome. It's like to be carried away by something. So I don't know how you can say that. Because that's
the super wildness of France.
And having given up, something that overcomes you, that keeps you overwhelmed in a way. And so because of which I might not actually know and see. If a mendicant is overcome with sensual desire, so now we're going into the specifics. It's their mind that's overcome. If a mendicant is overcome with ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse, doubt, pursuing speculations about the world, all these things, mental stuff, continually wounding each other with barbed wood, it's their mind that's overcome. They understand. So he goes on like this. And so, and then other questions that can be asked, when I develop, cultivate, and make much of this view, do I personally gain serenity and quenching? Quenching. It's like when you drink, and suddenly your thirst goes away. You're satisfied. So do you actually, if you cultivate it, do you actually feel that something is actually happening? I find if we are in this room, it's because we all at some point have sat on a cushion. What do we observe in terms of the way it actually modifies us profoundly? One of the things I've said many times is that when I started practicing, we all come for various reasons to the practice, to the sitting. For me, probably I would say it was a sense of feeling in exile with myself, disconnected. Because there were drama and pain and all that. And I think I used it in the beginning, in the early stages of my practice, I really used the practice to so that I can cope with my emotions, with the difficult sensations, and I learned to put it at a certain distance. Thanks to my various teachers, I realized that it's exactly the opposite that is meant to be practiced, which is, it's an investigation, a really heartfelt investigation about what is going on with our mind, what is going on with our life. Shakyamuni just started a community and with a small group of practitioners, and then it grew. And then, as any human organization, human groups, they quarreled, they disagreed. And there are other stories actually where Not on this sutra, but on other sutras where he's just really fed up with his people, his monks arguing, and he says, you know, you're going to figure it out, I'm going to go in the mountains, and then when I come back, you know, we'll see if you're still quarreling. We're humans. We have points of views. We have opinions that we hold on to. So how do we make peace from that? And so I mentioned in the text, he mentions these six warm-hearted qualities. Then he goes on to like seven knowledges that if we gain these knowledge is probably a bad word, because it's not an intellectual knowledge. It's like a really big, out of your experience, out of this cultivation, something that you really feel like this is absolutely appropriate. This is, I really have that experience. So peace comes, or this ending of suffering comes with this first, maybe let's call it experience, heartfelt experience, that there's nothing I am overcome with. I'm able to, in the Zen tradition, we say to dwell in nowhere, not being caught up by your desires, your sensations, and all that. And again, it doesn't mean not feeling these emotions. It means not being carried away. One word that I like very much that doesn't appear in the Pali Canon, but in a way it's kind of a modern way to think about these things, is am I being reactive? Am I reacting? Am I carried away by a total absence of will or total absence of control when I'm overwhelmed with sensual desires, with anger, with distress, or can I stay with this, stay in contact, and yet remain in a state where I can face that. I can experience that at a deep level and yet not be overcome by that. Not become reactive from that. So being able to, one word that I like also is to exhaust. You exhaust. You see it. I came out from a retreat. Krisha was there. It was kind of a difficult retreat for me for various reasons. And it was really just staying with the difficulty, staying with what was really hard, and just coping with that and seeing it and really seeing it. And then suddenly you start to see something that, yes, there's a resolve by the fact that you kind of exhaust the whatever the pain or the distress or whatever is happening at that moment. So that's the first heartfelt experience. Let's not call that knowledge. The second that he mentions, that you feel that when we practice, basically, when we develop and cultivate an appropriate view, an appropriate understanding of what's going on, we feel more serene. We feel more calm. So that's something also to reflect on with our practice. How do we feel afterwards? How do I feel after a workshop, a retreat? Or how do I, just after I sit for half an hour? I think it's with Juan that someone, I mentioned that years ago we had a meditation practice, and after the meditation practice, just there were two guys that started fighting in the apartment just after the sitting. Wow, what's happening here? We practice, and how long do we manage to maintain our sense of calmness, a sense of serenity? And I often say that I feel, for me, it's like, you know, when we sit on a retreat, or it's a little bit being in a lab, we're doing an experiment, but afterwards we deal with the real world. So how is that happening over there? Can we kind of bring that outside and behave with the same calm and serenity, and the serenity we potentially experience when we are sitting? I find it's a real question that we can ask ourselves. Paying attention to how we behave outside the realm of formal meditation, formal practice. The third one, I kind of don't like it, It's because it says basically that only Buddhist communities have this kind of view that I have. You know, the right ditti, the right view basically belongs to Buddhist communities. Probably at the time of the Buddha, you know, there were like all kinds of schools and teachers and alternative choices. Fourth and fifth are very interesting also, is basically that I have the same nature as a person who is accomplished in that view. In the Mahayana tradition, we call the Buddha nature. That really, basically, fundamentally, I trust that it's there. I can tap into that. I can really tap into my... Actually, I had a discussion with my teacher very recently. She's like, it's weird that she was telling me that she thought it was a little bit weird that I used the word teaching, because she feels that there is absolutely nothing to teach. Because if you have it, you have it. There's nothing that actually, there's nothing really that I can teach, because we already have that. So what is there to teach, really? What there is to realize, cultivate, is this thing that is already in there. But I think there's a, you know, knowing, like having the heartfelt, again, experience that it's possible. I can tap into, I can achieve that inner peace. What the Dalai Lama is experiencing is not something out of this world. It's just a question of, do I put the effort? Do I put a strong intention in there, in my practice, to cultivate this? And the sixth is, I have the same strength as a person accomplished in this ditti, in this understanding. Same thing. It's like whether Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, whoever, these, they inspire us because they are inspiring with the effort they put in. But it's nothing different than in nature. It's just there. It needs to be unfolded. That's all. And so the sixth is more, the sixth heartfelt experiences kind of invite us to pay heed and engage wholeheartedly and lend an ear to be able to hear. Pay attention to hear what's going on. And the seventh is to have the strength, but also in finding inspiration in the teaching and joy that is connected with the teaching. And I'm always so happy when I hear the word joy in these texts, because the path leads, the emancipation leads to joy. And I hope you've experienced that in your practice, that there are these moments, that these painful moments, but also, and at the same time, that these joyful moments. Last week at the retreat where I attended, and you attended too, there were like questions about the war in Ukraine and, you know, what should be done. And going back to my first question, it's like, if we choose peace, are we actually indulging into a discriminating mind? And if we pull the string of okay, it's just oneness, I'm going to stay in oneness, so it doesn't really make a difference if there's killing or not killing, if I do something or not do anything and all that. I feel that the first element of the Eightfold Path, this ditti, this right view or appropriate view, is rooted in an understanding and experience of the interconnectedness, the oneness of the world, how we are all connected, how the planet, how we are connected with the planet, how we depend on the planet, and so a sense of looking at it from a sense of a perspective, an understanding of our interdependence. And with the word peace and all that, being peace and choosing peace, it reminded me also of what John Lennon did in 1969 when he did his bed-ins. He would just invite all the journalists and he stopped and just wasn't in his bed. Not for, not against, just let's experience just doing nothing. Choosing peace. Choosing peace not out of I'm choosing war against peace. And I feel that we have a lot of, if we get too stuck, if we get too stuck in the absolute or too stuck in the not sure how to proceed, I feel we can really rely on various frameworks. I mean, what is in this text that I gave you? This so it's called the Mendicants of Kozumbi, the monks from Kozumbi. It's the Majjhima Nikaya, so the Middle Length Discourses, 48. It really gives us like a framework of questions that we can ask ourselves. But I was also thinking with the right view and. It's also the Eightfold Path that gives us a clear framework on which we can rely in order to navigate through life. Guided by what was he saying? By by a practice that is ennobling and emancipating. I find it always very inspiring to go back to the intentions. What do we do when we practice? On which path are we walking? Asking ourselves these questions. Why do I spend so much time doing what I'm doing right now? Sitting. And it's a project. There is a project. in this tradition. It's not just sitting on a cushion and hope for the best. There's a project, I say that because it's sometimes awkward, because at the same time we hear we need to drop everything, we need to drop even expectations, and so what's left? How do we approach that? How do we approach that contradiction that we need a certain amount of motivation to come to a place, to come here on a Friday night, where there are so many other great stuff to do, and at the same time we read that really to sometimes like to achieve enlightenment or whatever, to have a great experience, we need to drop even our our goals. And I think there's a subtle, it might be helpful to see that a goal and an intention is not the same thing. We have a strong intention to emancipate ourselves, to liberate ourselves, to live a flourishing life, to live more peacefully, to find inner peace, to be able to navigate in this world and create less harm. These are not goals, these are intentions. And our intention is to abide to these deep we want to abide to these deep aspirations, and this is, and practices of meditation among other practices is a wonderful tool to achieve that. But not only. And so, going back to that text, it's such an everyday experience to argue with people, to quarrel, to be mean with people, so using that as a teaching, using the relational element of our lives, can be such a leverage for our practice. And I like it that it's mentioned with our actions, with our speech, with our mind, like seeing the various layers that constitute our experience, and how and where we bring peace, or and where we bring in quietness, restlessness, open up the floor for discussion, sharing, and if you have any yeah.
What is the cue that leads us to peace? And what's the difference between the cue in this Theravada tradition, this text, and in Zen?
Well, just a question of terminology, but I think we have it. You know, when you present a koan, you express a view. In that sense, don't think of it as an equivalent to opinion. It's just this is why maybe understanding a deep understanding of something, and this is why also I avoid sometimes. You know, samaditi in the Eightfold Path. Sama sometimes translated as right, but probably it's more accurate to translate it as appropriate, because otherwise we get caught into this right or wrong. And at the same time, view shouldn't be seen as this is my opinion on something. It's like something, a large understanding. And what is my... I mean, when we act, when we respond to a situation, we always do it from a certain understanding. Always. We can't avoid that. So can we extend that? Can we make it as large as possible? And then also my response is going to be based on a understanding that is based on, I feel very much on the, you know, seeing the oneness, seeing interdependence or interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh speaks about it. You know, or in the text that we read, you know, the absolute and the relative. That understanding of the human experience.
That is what leads us to peace.
A part of it. It's not all. It's not all. Then it's the cultivation. Then it's the. It's just again like the framework of the Eightfold Path. The view is just one element, but then you have concentration, you have livelihood, you have right action, appropriate speech. You know, the way we speak, the way we talk, concentration, intention, etc., etc. But I think it's a team player business, you know. It's if there's just concentration and no intention, if there's just right speech, but then you act like, you know, in. That's not going to lead to peace. So in the text, it really distinguishes these various elements: mental, you know, the mind, action, speech, and all that. I think we need to take it as a bundle.
But you see the difference between that approach to view and the Zen approach.
No, I don't think so. No, it's just a different literary form. But I mean, all the koan practices that we've done, that we do in our lineage, is exactly that. Is exactly to get us. I would say this is a little bit more explicit. And sometimes I feel the Zen tradition, it's a bit more packed. But it's really all the, you know, when you present a koan, appropriate answer. Appropriate for, depending on the conditions, depending on the stories. So are you familiar with koans? Well, not at all. Don't know what that is. Koans, I'm sorry, I'm using if koans are... stories that have been...
Say no.
Oh, okay.
The
okay, right. So and so we usually, the way it's in the Zen tradition, we really practice, we sit with these questions, we see what comes up, and then we see our teacher and we present our understanding, but it's never an intellectual understanding. So it's always very often something that we do or something that we might say, but that goes beyond precisely discriminating mind.
So the difference is, if there is one, there is various traditions, so the difference is the approach, the practice.
Yeah, you could say the approach, the practice. I mean, you know, here in a way, when what I read, where he asked questions, we could take it as koans. That would work, you know, for us. And we could find an equivalent to these exact questions in Dogen, probably. You know, it's just set up differently.
Yeah.
But I find in Zen very often it's very hidden. Or we don't necessarily know the roots, but if you look at the roots, it goes back to that. You know, I mean, what we recite. Just think about all the few texts that we recite. You know, the structure is there already, and the format might be slightly different, but the structure and the understanding is the same. That would be my take on that. That's my take on that. Yeah, that it's, yeah.
Staying on the piece, you talked about six stuff. Sorry.
Right.
Word.
Right.
And you talk about, we talked about that in our retreat in Belgium also, the word, I forget it, stingy.
Stingy, yeah.
I asked what it meant, right. I already forget it.
Right.
But
when you don't want to give, you keep for yourself, stingy.
What would be in Portuguese wrong? Aferento. Okay. And it will be like Ebenezer Scrooge.
It would be
Ebenezer, what? Ebenezer Scrooge Christmas type. Never mind, sorry. But I think the path to peace is much about, at least from a relative view, much about that point. Because when we are quarreling, we really are holding to something.
Yeah.
Or we don't want to hear, we don't give space to the other, or it's too much important for us to make sure our point is understood and taken by the other, and not, you know, not to be stingy about it. That's the real difficulty of our relative world.
Right. Well, yeah.
And I like that step. No, it's not a step. That's
six
qualities you have to cultivate.
Right. Treat companions with bodily kindness. Treat companions with verbal kindness, mental kindness. Share without reservation.
Share without reservation.
Live according to the precepts. And in the precept, you already have anyway the body, the mind, and you already have it actually. So you're back on track. And six, living according to the view that it is noble and emancipating, and leads one who practices it to the complete ending of suffering. So you could say that also is the refuge actually. You take refuge. You believe that path is going to lead you. You trust that path is going to lead you to a flourishing life. I don't like really liberation, but a flourishing life. I like that.
Yeah, or the end of suffering, if you understand, give without with no reservation.
Yeah.
What are you giving?
Yeah.
Just zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the end, if you really give it, it's the end.
Yeah. Well, I personally have a little problem with this whole Buddhist thing of the end of suffering. I'm not quite sure what it means, or I'm not. I mean, I know what it means, but I'm not. I have a little reservation about that. I think in the West, we have a tendency to, because, you know, it's the. I mean, okay. The end of suffering is the end of dukkha, right? That's the translation we usually use. So, we have two options. The traditional view, actually, very traditional, orthodox, that is written explicitly, is dukkha is actually not just suffering. It's all kinds of things, including old age, sickness, and etc. So, what?
Burning.
Well, being born, yeah, being born, yeah. Just so all the various elements of life, the tragedy of life in all its diversity, right? So the understanding is actually reaching nirvana, reaching. So it's the traditional understanding is linked to the cycle of dependent arising. So basically, if you drop all desires, etc., your conditioning, you don't get reborn. And so there's no life anymore, right? So, and therefore there's no dukkha, because there is no life, there is no death, there is nothing else, right? I think there's, and because we, in the West, we're not very necessarily comfortable with that option, with that cosmological understanding, we tend to understand suffering as just psychological, so we stay on the psychological level, right? So we don't take the other part because we're not comfortable with that. So it becomes just I stop holding on to my stuff, to my opinions, and therefore I have less psychological suffering, which is true.
Yeah.
But that's not going to resolve the fact that I'm going to get old and I'm going to die and I'm going to get sick. So the problem of dukkha understood traditionally still remains in that case. This is why we tend to, you know, bring it to just state on the psychological level. What's my experience? My experience is that the more we practice, the more, yes, there's a flourishing life, and then I still stumble with a lot of to grief. When someone dies, to pain, to physical pain, when I'm sick, to all kinds of things. But the way, yes, I do handle it might be slightly different than what you don't practice. So yes, there is some truth in the psychological thing.
It's just not, it doesn't end.
It doesn't end. It just, it doesn't end that way.
Yeah.
Or in the kind of, the Zen kind of thing, you know, if you drop the notion of suffering, yes, there is an end to suffering, because you just drop the notion of suffering, it's just experience, and that's it. It's just, then that's also another understanding of it. Yeah.
Yeah, one other translation, more generally, is the phenomenal world is dukkha, is unsatisfactory, does not fulfill.
I'm sorry, what?
Unsatisfactory.
Unsatisfactory.
Unsatisfactory,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Instead of suffering.
Yeah.
Does not fulfill.
Yeah, the problem again with that is, you know, I remember when I translated Stephen Batchelor's Buddhism Without Beliefs, he used precisely that. Not unsatisfactory, but yeah, something like that, something to that effect, to translate dukkha. And then 20 years later, he realized that again, he was trapped into the psychological understanding, and so he, and so this is why we don't translate it, actually, because it's really complicated to translate that as suffering.
I think we have to see the other the elements of dukkha, of the impermanence of things, the interdependence of things, the non-I of things.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's unsatisfactory.
Yeah.
It does not fulfill. It can't fulfill.
What can't be fulfilled?
The phenomenal world.
Fulfill, what do you mean by fulfill?
Live fully, live happily.
You can't?
No, if you are...
If you're stuck. If you're stuck. Yes. If you're stuck, you're gonna... Yes, and this is why I find it's very interesting to kind of reflect from time to time how our practice transformed us. You know, how do we cope? Do we cope better with reality, with people? Friends can be a good indicator. They can give us feedbacks about how we get transformed, our partner, and be attentive, paying attention to how that works for us. Dukkha is a very rich term. There's a sutra where actually there's a definition that is given, and it really just like it's basically the whole package of life with its joy and its difficulties. And so life is all that.
Is here the time we bring equanimity?
Yeah, that's also a quality to be developed, and that fuels peace, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
So can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What can you say about action, non-action, and being passive, or like the difference between acting or trying to understand what non-action is, and also not being passive, or what's the difference between those concepts?
Mm. Yeah. What's your take?
Well, in my experience, because I had some, problems growing up, so I became very shy and very quiet, so I struggled with the feeling of not being able to participate or socialize. So to speak would be a hard action for me. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do it. But the concept of non-action maybe can be mistaken by being passive, because I can try and think, oh, but maybe I should let things be the way they are, mm-hmm. and remain in my habit, which is to be close and not step out of my comfort zone. So it's like the balance between acting or trying to accept things the way they are, but not accept or try to change for the better, but also trying to accept, so like accepting versus trying to change things.
I feel the key word in what you said is habit. That's the turning point. That's a possible turning point. When we see that there's a habit, that's reactivity. You just do things not out of will, but just because either you can't do otherwise or you're stuck somewhere. And there's no choice. And there's no freedom. So not doing it because of there's a habit not to do it, this is not cultivating a flourishing life. This is not cultivating. This is cultivating repetitive patterns. And I think one of the ways to understand this dependent arising model in Buddhism, this traditional model, is to understand it in terms of repetitive patterns. This is what it points to. How do I get out of repetitive patterns? My own repetitive patterns, my own habits that forbids me to live fully. And if you notice that in yourself, just like you pay attention, oh yeah, I don't want to speak because he's going to think, oh, I can't. It's just like, yeah, that's your repetitive pattern. That's where you're stuck. So then what kind of practices can I do in order to unlock this? It's not anymore a question of action and non-action. It's a question of getting out of reactivity, getting out of repetitive patterns. And that's where we gain a lot of freedom and a lot of inner peace. Because then, if you say, you know, it's not appropriate to speak right now. I could, but it's not appropriate. You're able to have a larger diti, a larger view of what's going on. This is not appropriate. This is appropriate. And then I should speak, and it's fine. You know, and have a better sense. But you could also go the other way. It's like, I always want to speak. Yeah, I'm, you know, and that's your ego talking, and then you don't realize it, and then you need the validation of others and all that. So again, paying attention to that other extreme. It's like, why do I want to speak actually all the time? That can be a pattern. That speaks to you.
Thanks. So I guess it has more to do with trying to understand moment to moment or situation to situation what's happening, and maybe sometimes I don't need to speak or it's not necessary.
Yeah.
Sometimes I may want to, but feel like I can't, and then to speak would be to break the chain. So it's more like a moment-to-moment understanding, I guess.
Yes, I mean, there is a... Also, your question brings me also to a possible misunderstanding that there is with meditation about, you know, being... I mean, if we're very cliché, I meditate, the world is kind of away from me, I don't get involved because I'm beyond and everything is perfect and everything is one and everything is, there's nothing to do, there's nowhere to intervene. You know, you can have a, to the extreme, it can sound like that. I think it's the exact opposite. I sit down so that I have a much larger view of what's going on. I'm not carried away, overcome by my desires, my opinions, my stuff, my stuff. I am not overcome. And therefore, I can take an appropriate action based on what I see, what I feel, what I can be wrong, but it's larger. So it actually pushes you to do whatever needs to be done, actually. But where do you speak from? What's the fundamental intention? If that fundamental intention is not clear, obviously the action is not going to be clear either. So, you know, I think there's a misunderstanding in thinking that would just... And And also our opinions about what is action and what is non-action. Is a monk in a cave in Nepal sitting 12 hours a day just someone who is doing nothing and not contributing to the world? I mean, depends how you look at it. John Lennon sitting on his hotel just saying, I'm not part of that circus. And then suddenly journalists came and just like, we're very intrigued, but what do you do? I'm just sitting here. That we created, we're still talking about it, you know, 50 years later. It can be very powerful not to do, just to stop. And I feel, I mean, we keep saying that in our Zen group, it's like, it's so radical. Just to sit and do nothing. Do nothing. It's extremely radical. So it's certainly doing something in some sense. In some other sense, it's, yeah, we are practicing non-doing. Not getting involved in the way we... Everyone wants us to get involved. Repetitive patterns and become reactive and indulge ourselves in all kinds of things that are useless, and etc., etc. So intention is key, and I find, you know, thinking of it as repetitive patterns and breaking away from repetitive patterns can be a useful tool, and then it's just, yeah, really paying attention to what's going on in our lives. It's 9:15. Any other comments, questions, sharing? Yeah.
What's your normal day?
What's my normal day?
Like
oof. Oof. It's very difficult to say, I have all different activities. I'm a writer. I work for communication agencies. So I have these things going when I have projects to do. There's a meditation group that we have, and we have almost daily, I mean, from Tuesday to Friday events, study groups on Saturday. So I do things. I wake up really early usually. And I work in the morning, and I sit, and then I'm trying to find time in the morning to find some space, basically. To find some space. Take some time really for myself. And when I can, not to go straight away into tasks that I need to do. But just let things float a little bit. So it can be creative writing, usually it's writing. And part of that moment is meditation also. And then I get swept away by all the administrative tasks and the work and all that. Yet, I pay extreme attention to how I do it. I notice, as all of us, you know, I can procrastinate on certain things that I don't want to do. And then I really pay really clear attention to that. And I realize that sometimes when I just procrastinate, it becomes really painful. So I'm like, okay, just do it. Just do it. Forget it. Drop it. Drop it. Drop. Just no gap. No gap. And then I just do it. And I find I'm a lay teacher. So I have a wife. I have a normal life. I have a job. I have kinds of activities and social engagements, and this is practice. This the whole bunch is practice. I teach in the school also meditation, mindfulness. That's part of it, but going there is also part of it, and it's inspiring. Going there, driving a car, and paying attention to the sensations that goes through me, the various moods that Miguel was talking about, impermanence, how it's shifting all the time. So it's difficult to say, like, I don't have a regular day, because sometimes I'm on retreat, sometimes I have lots of work, sometimes I have less work, but what's kind of common is getting up early, trying to find moments just for myself, and then practice in the shit of the regular normal tasks that I need to do. So there is hope. I don't envy anymore monks. I used to envy monks a lot. People who can...
I'm sorry for interrupt, but monks in Zen tradition still get married.
Yeah, but it wasn't just for the getting married. It was for the being, you know, being to live in a monastery where you can really do the real stuff, which is really the practice, sitting on a cushion. That's the real practice. And I find the quarreling thing that the Buddha addresses in this text. What?
You want to quarrel about the robe.
About the robe?
I'm kidding, you know. Monks quarrel about their problems. The food, it's not enough.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it reminds me when I was in Thailand in 2019, in the monastery, and there were like ceremonies, and then the formal stuff was the monks were receiving robes. But then I would see a huge amount of robes like being given. I was like, where does that go? But in fact, it was like a circle. It was always the same robe that were like given. So they didn't have like a pile of, I imagine, like when I was seeing that, I was like, do they have like a god robe or like 45 robes each? No, they didn't.
Let me share about the robes. Ajahn Sumedho, in one of his books, talks a whole paragraph about what were that his problems was the color of the robe.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give me the brownish, give me the yellow. Because, you know, he was only meditating in a monastery, and that's what came up to him that week, and his Ajahn Sumedho.
Right. So that's the great news. We see that it's even in a monastery, you start to hold on, cling to things. And the job is really to look at it and see what is going on here. What's the repetitive pattern? What am I getting caught with? What am I overcome with, as the text says? Yeah. That's our job. Getting out of repetitive patterns and find peace through that. Yeah. It's stopping. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're good on time with the time, right? Perfect.
Yeah.
Right. Good. All right. Thank you.
We don't think.
We haven't discussed it.
We haven't. What do you do here usually with your groups?
It's not my group, it's many
groups. Many groups, okay.
But what was the question?
How do you end? How do you end?
Normally, it's just kind of dedicate the merit for facing work.
For? The peace in the world? Well, that's very appropriate.
Yes.
We'll do that's very appropriate for this evening. So, yeah, let's do that too. To send the merits of our practice and our dedication to the peace, to peace in this world that really needs it. Thank you. Yeah.